Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to History Hack. We're going to a period of history we don't often visit today, aren't we, Zach?
We are. I'm ignorant. Well, actually, that's just a standard comment when it comes to me, isn't it? I'm just ignorant. But I'm particularly ignorant about this one because we're doing a bit of maritime trade, but we're looking at the Indian subcontinent and we're taking it way, way back. We're talking eras of history that I barely know even exist, and I'm pretty sure Alex is pretty clueless about as well. To help us through it all, we are joined by Nick Collins, who at one point scorned life as an academic, can kind of see some of the temptations of that some of the time, and instead went and worked for the world's largest shipping company. But he's now seen the light, he says. I think he's been tempted back to the dark side. And the result is a fantastic book about maritime trade in the Indian subcontinent and the way in which it shaped the world. Nick, welcome to History Hack. How are you doing?
Thanks. Thank you for a very nice introduction. I didn't really scorn academia. It was more my dad had been a teacher. All his friends were teachers. I'd been to school and university, and I needed to go and see the real world, you know.
It's all right. Zach's currently applying for academic funding in that, so you can scorn away at this point. He's had enough. He's going to follow you.
No, I've come back.
We are going way, way back. Our story starts in the Ice Age. Why is 5,600 BC a key date in your story?
Okay. Well, the last glacial maximum is around about 18,000 BC. And then around 12,000 or so, it gradually starts to warm. And what we have are three big, the sea starts to rise, but there were three particularly main mega melts, one about 12,000 BC, one about 9,500 BC, and or 9,600 BC, and the last one, 5,600 BC, and that was the flood. And it wasn't a biblical event only, it was a worldwide flood. It's not controversial, it's well known, and the evidence for it is found, well, recently they found some underwater megalithic structures off Okinawa and the Penghu archipelago. There's in 2000, lost ports were found on the west coast of India in the Gulf of Cambay, and they've been it's difficult to dive down there, but they've had the sonar testing, and the sonar images are stunning. Basically, a 9 by 2 kilometer port by the banks of an ancient river. And they've dredged up some very, very ancient stuff from there, wattle and daub and stones and instruments. And then in the Mediterranean, of course, there was the flooding of the then Black Sea, which was then a freshwater lake. Then there's evidence on the west coast of Britain and Scandinavia, a big silt deposit where the tsunami, which was caused by the melting of what is thought to be the ice in the St. James Bay, Hudson Bay area, and must have devastated the whole of that coast. And, you know, it's been carbon dated in the Persian Gulf as well. You get a whole new set of of settlements springing up about 5,500, 5,400 BC. And they've been carbon dated there. The seashells and the former shoreline, sorry, the freshwater shells on the former shoreline of the Black Sea. And they all come down to there. 5,600 BC or there or thereabouts. I mean, there are various theories about the myth of Atlantis. I rather like, I'm most persuaded by Peter James's arguments that it's the ancient city of Tantalus, which is an anagram of Atlantis, which was destroyed, gosh, I can't remember now, somewhere about 3,000 or something like, maybe earlier, 3,000 BC, something like that. It's in Anatolia.
So obviously you're talking about massive changes in coastlines and settlements and that. So presumably trade exists before that, but it changes massively at this point.
Well, the trade in the Indian Ocean, we can say that it was happening during the Ice Age because the temperature in the Indian Ocean then would have been a little bit cooler than now, but still pretty balmy and Mediterranean type. And there's plenty of evidence of shared stories from the Persian Gulf through to Japan that all display very similar traits. So we know that there's interconnectivity, and we should infer from that that goods were being exchanged, even if the volumes were very small. But what happens after 5,600 is that, let's go geographically. In Britain, it until 2015, the story was that agriculture didn't arrive with Indo-European colonists until somewhere around 4,300 BC or something. And then in 2015, archaeologists found in the Solent some evidence of wheat growing and even flour making dating to 6,000, in other words, before the flood. So we must assume that a lot of these settlements were wiped out during the flood and that agricultural development was put back in Britain. But when they did, when the Celts finally arrived in Ireland, for example, the seed fields where there's about 560 miles of stone walls now covered over by peat have been found, the most extensive Neolithic field system. It indicates that the agriculture made a difference on the population, and judging by figures of hunter-gatherers as opposed to agriculturalists in New Guinea, probably 40 or 50 times the population. So they knew where to come, they knew where they'd come from. So the interconnectivity between the Celtic lands of the British Isles and Brittany and Iberia, there must have been a huge amount of interconnectivity there, which we see in the evidence much later, but it's got to have been there before. And in the Indian Ocean, well, the ports were devastated, but new ones were built because the continental shelf along India is not shallow, whereas in Southeast Asia, the what is called Sundaland, a massive area of land, was completely devastated, and then it became what it is now, a series of islands.
So one of the civilizations that you talk about is the Indus Sarasvati. I've probably done a horrific job on the pronunciation there. What was that civilization? What was kind of specific and important about it in terms of impact? But equally, why does it end up declining?
Okay. We talked about the rise in sea levels, but the other thing that was going on was that the glaciers were melting, especially in the Himalayas, and this carved out a huge river basin where that was flowing down into the Gulf of Cambay. And the greatest of the river, I mean, we call it now the Indus civilization. I call it the Indus Sarasvati, because the Sarasvati was the greatest of the rivers, of many of the rivers. There's lots of rivers. But what these rivers did was they fertilized a huge area. Canals were built. And so around 3000, I mean, this has been developing since the end of the Ice Age. But what happens at about 3100 BC is that the bronze is discovered, how to alloy bronze between tin and copper. And this increases the amount of the effectiveness of tools. And so this civilization starts to accelerate in its sophistication. And you get about 300 or 400 riverine cities, a few thousand dependent settlements. It's over a huge area. And it's thought that perhaps 10% of the world's then population lived there. So important was it that a lot of civic buildings have been found, unlike Egypt and Mesopotamia. Very few, if any, royal palaces have been found, or that's the interpretation, but civic buildings, granaries, canals, dockyards, and all designed on a specific geometric ratio. In fact, they were very clever at this. And in fact, their altars were reduced in size or increased in size based on using Pythagoras' theorem, which Pythagoras, a couple of thousand years later, discovered on a trip to India. So it was immensely important, and it had ports, and it traded, well, north and south, but mainly to the Middle East, to Samaria. Now, here we go. I mean, it's a commonplace that the Middle East is the cradle of civilization, but it's not. It was India. They had the first cities. They had the first ports before the Ice Age, and when the Middle Eastern Sumerian civilization developed, they were dependent on Indian products: timber, cotton, food. And so that was the supply route. The end of the Indus-Sarasvati civilization was because this whole area is where the tectonic plate of the Indian Ocean comes up against the one that has created the Himalayas, and is prone to very frequent earthquakes. And that river system that I described changed quite a number of times over the few thousand years. But the biggest one was the disappearance of the river Sarasvati, and caused by an earthquake. It dried up. The rivers that fed it instead went into the Ganges, and its sacredness was transferred to the Ganges. But what this did was that the Sarasvati, being the biggest one, I think it was 5 miles wide in a lot of areas, and therefore carried a lot of water, drying up, it destroyed many, many cities and dependent towns and villages. And some were left high and dry, some were covered in silt. And what that meant was that there was a big exodus of people to the Ganges Valley, for sure, some think to Sri Lanka, and a number of groups, probably military groups, into the Middle East via that trade route. Because suddenly, in the Middle East, we get Kassites, Hittites, Mitanni, and others appearing suddenly, and not to mention Greeks and almost certainly Trojans. So that kind of was a push to already developing Mediterranean trade.
It's fascinating, isn't it? It's like shifting the whole axis of your understanding of human history. So let's look at the Bronze Age. Is there a rise here in Europe's fortunes?
Well, certainly in the Mediterranean, which is developed from, well, conventionally dated, but we'll maybe come on to that in a minute, but 3000 BC, the origin of the Pharaonic civilization in Egypt, and the Phoenicians, who were, which looks like a planned settlement, with the Phoenicians resident in Egypt, but also in Tyre, Sidon, and Byblos. And in Byblos, they were shipping down timber to Egypt, which is timber deficient. So this whole westward move from the Indian Ocean started funneling more goods of Indian Ocean type into the Mediterranean, and that's where we get the beginnings of the Minoan civilization on Crete, and the ports being the Phoenician ports, but also Ugarit, which is in Syria, now destroyed. But that had five harbors and was fanning out, distributing goods all over the Mediterranean. And then you've got Cyprus, where copper was discovered, which is the main ingredient for bronze. So this whole Levant coast, Cyprus, Crete, and of course Egypt, this whole movement of goods would increased very rapidly. But the Egyptians weren't seafarers. The main ones were the Cretans and the Phoenicians.
You dropped us a little sort of hint there about Troy. Does the Battle of Troy have an impact on maritime trade? And if so, what?
Troy was, how far do I go back? Troy was the gateway to the Black Sea. And it was almost certainly deliberately located there by Trojans because of that. They seem to be also late Indo-Europeans, probably connected in some way with the Greeks, who were not a uniform people. They were, Homer describes them as Hellenes and Danaans and Argives and Aeolians, but culturally similar. And they inhabited what is now Western Turkey and what is now Greece. And they invaded a very lightly populated country, which historians, the inhabitants of which historians called the Pelasgians. And it was lightly inhabited because, as always, Greece is not particularly fertile. In fact, 30% of its land can be agriculturally developed, but only 20% any good. So this huge influx of people, and probably the remnants of the Hyksos invaders of Egypt, where Pharaoh Amhotep kicked them out, they almost certainly went to Greece. Herodotus tells us quite a lot about that. So the Greeks were overpopulated in this not particularly fertile area. And so at once they started going on a maritime search for food to Tuscany, to southern Italy, to Sicily, southern France, even a little bit into Iberia. But most of all, they prioritized the food-rich Black Sea. And to get through the Black Sea, they needed Troy's assistance or its destruction. And that is the cause of the Trojan War, access to the Black Sea. And when they got there, and this is not conventional chronology, but because conventional chronology does not make any sense at all, they developed the colonies in the Crimea and the Sea of Azov, which shipped back food, fish, wheat, especially wheat from the Black Earth regions of today's Ukraine, which they developed with the Scythians, fruit and all that kind of stuff. And that fed Greece. So, yes, the Trojan War, a 10-year battle or 10-year war, apparently, according to Homer, was vitally important for feeding Greece and maritime trade. And the Greeks, the later Greeks, thought it was the most important important point in history because it was their salvation. Greece always, even through the classical times, always had a problem with food supply. It's well documented, uncontroversial, but it started not in the classical times, but before the Trojan War, and was relieved by the Trojan War.
You've mentioned classical times there. What can you tell us about what you call the Clash of the Titans? Because this must have a knock-on effect beyond the Indian subcontinent in terms of maritime trade.
Yes. Well, the book is about maritime trade worldwide, but the supreme importance of the centrality of India in the Indian Ocean. So, yes, the Clash of the Titans chapter is really about this ongoing problem with food security. It's always been a problem in the Mediterranean. And so what you've got is the Greeks having a secured Black Sea food supply through the Trojan War, then come across the Persians. And the Persians are advancing, threatening the Black Sea, and they're either side of the Hellespont, threatening the food supply. And then they go on to conquer Egypt, which is also the breadbasket of the Mediterranean. So they were defeated eventually. But then you've got the Carthaginians and the Greeks in Sicily fighting. It's all for control of food and the trade routes for food sources. Sicily being another grain-rich area. And eventually you've got the Romans coming in. And as they expand up through the Italian peninsula, they become a bit short of grain as well. So they've got to have Sicily. And then they get bigger still. And so they've got to have Egypt. They get to their olive oil and grain from Iberia, from Spain, in other words. And so they're fighting each other from the time of the Trojan War until Augustus's triumph in the first century BC, all for supply of trade routes to supply food. So that's the Clash of the Titans. It's the Carthaginians, the Romans, the Greeks, the Persians, and it's these are the wars of those centuries.
You refer to the Roman and the Han empires as tentative globalization, which is one of those things where people sometimes you get academics who sort of suck their teeth and go, "Oh, can you use that term in that context?" So why do you kind of refer to it as tentative globalization? Talk us through your reasoning behind that.
Yes, I know that the globalization is one of those things in 19th century history that gets people agitated. Well, it's basically because there was a huge trade between the Roman Empire from the time of Augustus with India. In fact, bullion was shipped to India, and in return, cotton textiles, drugs, medicines, timber, pearls, diamonds, and other precious stones were all shipped back through Egypt building on what the Ptolemies had started trading with India. When Rome conquered it, they continued it, but massively scaled it up. In the first century and early second century, it was taxed by the Romans at 25%. And one estimate, which I think is persuasive, says that financed about half the whole of the Roman Empire, just a tax on this Indian trade. Now, the Roman merchants, and they probably weren't Roman, but they were probably what they always been, Greek and Levantine, Phoenicians, now in the first century converted to Judaism. And they were penetrating West Coast India, then East Coast India. And then in the early second century, they were getting over to Southeast Asia and eventually got to Okio, which was a port in the Mekong Delta. And there they exchanged goods, but also they were taken on to China, where it's reported that there was, this is 166 AD, that there was an embassy, a Roman embassy, visiting the Chinese court. And it is thought that not only did they want to exchange goods, but that they wanted an alliance with the Chinese to attack the Persians in the middle. But anyway, this didn't go on because just a year before, China had succumbed to a massive plague where about a third of the population died. It then came into the Roman Empire a year later, in 166, by coincidence, and a third of the population of Europe died. So it's tentative because it never went anywhere. It stopped. European demand for all those Indian products suddenly was decimated. And among those people that were most badly affected were miners, gold miners. So gold, which was being shipped to India, was no longer available. And so, the globalization stopped. Indian Ocean trade continued, but at a much lower level, into the 400s or 500s.
It's remarkable, isn't it? New foundations are laid, though, in terms of trade networks in Asia and the Indian Ocean. How?
Well, I think rather than new, I think they continued, but without the impetus of Roman bullion. But they continued throughout Asia, whereas European trade steadily declined in the Mediterranean and North Europe. It rose in Asia basically because of the growing Chinese civilization. They were ethnically cleansing. They'd come from the center of China, what we call Han Chinese. They were ethnically cleansing the Yu, who were the maritime population, from maritime China. And their demand was being fueled by products from Southeast Asia. And this helped those states become states, political formations in Southeast Asia. So by the end of the period, by let's say 680, the Srivijayan Empire is formed among those polities in Southeast Asia, centered on Palembang in Sumatra. It basically controls the Kra Isthmus and the Malacca Straits and Sunda Straits, which are the choke points connecting the Indian Ocean to East Asia. So this maritime empire then controls all the newfound trade. And essentially it's about, I mean, there's of course there's tremendous demand and supply in India, but the new factor that you're referring to is the new growth of Chinese demand.
Within these, are there shifts in areas of influence, such as a rise and fall in the Red Sea? Because obviously we're looking at like really big regional, like Middle East, Mediterranean, that are there nuances within them?
Well, yes. When the Sarasvati dried up and there were these migrations into the Middle East, then that was mainly through the Persian Gulf. When the Ptolemies, when Alexander conquered Egypt, the Ptolemies then developed trading with India, with the Red Sea. And in fact, before that, there was a very important link between Phoenician Hiram of Tyre and King Solomon, who did a deal together by using the port of Ezion Geber in the Gulf of Aqaba. They did joint voyages to India. This is around 950 BC or so. But what the Ptolemies did was increase those voyages. The Solomon and Hiram voyages were we're told that they went once every 3 years for about a century. The Ptolemies did was increase that number. We're told by classical writers about 20 ships a year. And then when the Romans come along, they increased that to about 120 ships a year. So yes, that was a big issue, and it increased the importance of the Red Sea as against the importance of the Persian Gulf as conduits for Indian Ocean goods getting into the Mediterranean. By the end of this period, 750, we get the establishment of the Abbasid Empire centered on Baghdad, and Baghdad becomes a big inland port with its outlying port on the coast of Basra becomes the main conduit. So yes, you get this, depending on political situations and various conquests and natural disasters, you get a rise and fall of the importance of the Red Sea or the Persian Gulf.
Really interested to know as well. So your book goes to the middle of the 8th century, and another sort of cataclysmic world events that happens in that period is the foundation of Islam. And that's how does the Prophet and Islam come into the story?
Well, at the fall of really kind of ever since this 166 epidemic, the Roman Empire did this slow motion collapse to the 5th century, well, 6th century, I suppose, depending on whether you think that the Roman Empire ended in 475 with the last emperor retiring or being thrown out, or whether it was the subsequent rulers who basically ruled in Italy. But basically what you've got is a declining economy. And the economy declined in Asia, not in Asia, but in the Middle East as well. And so probably at the lowest point, the merchant, Muhammad, thinks that a way of revival is a new religion, an Arab-centered religion. And his successor then founds the first dynasty, which tries to conquer Constantinople, and then again, very bad effects on trade and the movement of goods in the Mediterranean, which almost ceases. It probably had ceased a little time before that in Northern Europe. But as I said, then his successor, the Abbasids, found Baghdad, and then there's a whole new era of maritime trade in Asia. But and here we come. That's the end of the book, basically, because because what you've got is maritime trade in Europe virtually ceasing. It's gone, which means that there's a huge decline in population, of interconnectivity, whereas in Asia, despite the fact that the Romans are no longer pumping bullion into the Pacific economy, Indian Ocean economy, I should say. As I said, the trade continues from East Africa to Persian Gulf through India into Southeast Asia and China. And it's voluminous and it's fantastic. And the contrast couldn't be starker. So that seemed to be a good point to end the book.
That's a really interesting, that was exactly what I was going to ask. You know, what was the thinking behind ending the book there? Can you give us just a sort of a sense of the legacy, if you like, of the period that you've been looking at and sort of what shifts beyond the middle of the 8th century?
Well, yes, the book ends there because, as I said, the contrast couldn't be starker, but also book two in the series of the history of maritime trade, the next one is 700 to 1700. And in 700, you've got absolutely zero, virtually zero going on in Europe. By 1700, a north corner, northwest Europe, is pushing out, dominating the Mediterranean, it's dominating the Americas, and it's making great strides in Asia. So I call it the Millennium Maritime Trade Revolution, 700 to 1700. So it seems like a nice, neat fit. The legacy? I think the most important thing is to is that, as far as I'm aware, nobody has tackled ancient history on a trade basis, on an economic basis. And I think we need to know what happened so that we can put it in context with later history and indeed today. It was extremely frustrating to research this because so few people had actually looked at it. And and Indian historians tend to concentrate on India, and Mediterranean historians concentrate on the Mediterranean and Romans and the Greeks. And the Egyptian historians are extremely jealous of their subjects' unique identity, as are Assyrian historians. And it just needed putting together by means of trade. So I think hopefully shining a light on that is the most important thing.
I have to say that as I was reading it, one thing that struck me, and even more so listening to you talk about it, is the phenomenal amount of background knowledge you have to be able to wax lyrical about Bronze Age and then Ice Age India, and then sort of like coming into what Eleanor Yaniger will kill us if we refer to as the Dark Ages, but sort of the early medieval period. It just, the amount of knowledge you have is quite staggering.
Well, thank you. I did do quite a lot of reading.
Yeah, I imagine you've been drowning in it. So remind everybody again what the book is called.
The book is How Maritime Trade and the Indian Subcontinent Shaped the World, Ice Age to Mid-8th Century. There it is.
Absolutely daunting subject, handled very skillfully. Thank you so much, Nick, for joining us.
Well, thank you. Please have me back when the next one's published.
Absolutely, yeah, we need to carry on with the story. I sense you will not be struggling so much for source material for the next one.
It's already written and it's with the publishers, so maybe towards the end of this year. I don't know, this book was 10 months later than it should have been because of COVID, I suppose. This one, I hope it'll be on time, but we'll see.
And I'm guessing that you then have to do 1700 to the present day?
Doing it, I'm working on it now.
Wow, that is absolutely daunting. So what you've essentially taken on is a complete history of maritime trade the world over.
I had a degree in history and I spent my whole career in maritime trade. So, and nobody else had done it. So I thought, well, I'll bloody do it.
Kudos to you. Zach and I will just carry on with the little minutiae of Crime and Punishment and generals in the First World War and stuff, because just this kind of sweeping history is quite terrifying. But you've handled it brilliantly.
Thank you.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.